Tim O'Reilly is the founder of O'Reilly Media. He's been in the publishing business since 1978. O'Reilly Media got their start doing technical writing, but began moving into producing hard copy manuals and reference books to help readers use information technologies. You may have seen their popular Missing Manual and In a Nutshell series on bookshelves. Being at the intersection of information technology and publishing has put Tim in the interesting position of seeing the new wave of publishing coming at him from a distance. As such, his company has taken a particularly aggressive approach by embracing ebooks early on, experimenting with pricing for different niches, and testing different models for writing and releasing literature. But while Tim's philosophy is clear, the printed word will never be what it once was. He compares the printed book to the LP record. There are still plenty of open questions. Tim sat down with David Weinberger to talk about how life as a publisher has changed.
So what's the future of paper books?
It's always difficult to predict the future, and you get most predictions wrong. But I think most people have the assumption that books will be around for a lot longer than I think possible that they might well be. Because it's not just a matter of consumer demand. People might want books, want paper books for a lot longer than publishers are willing to produce them. And the reason for that are simply the economics of print. There may be a point at which it costs so much to produce certain kinds of books because the demand is sufficiently low in print, that even with print-on-demand, you just go, it's just not worth it. Yeah, again, if print-on-demand becomes ubiquitous, you kind of say, okay, well, sure, it's always affordable. But we don't know what the economics of this future are going to be. Certainly at O'Reilly already, there are certain kinds of books that we would have published years ago that we don't publish anymore because there's just not enough sales volume. And while digital is increasing radically, it's not necessarily increasing enough or in the right areas to say, oh, yeah, that kind of book would work anymore. So it's sort of like any ecosystem. There are hidden dependencies, hidden interrelationships that mean that the future doesn't happen smoothly. It's not just, paper books go down, ebooks go up. There's sort of chaotic discontinuities in the system. And I don't think we know what they're going to be. But I certainly think, that when we look at, for example, the future of libraries, there's going to be a lot of interesting questions to ask. What do we do when books are published e-only? What do we do when we think about important things that ought to be kept and collected that aren't books, and there are more of those than there are books? When a web page or a video or an app is the thing that ought to be preserved.
It seems like there are two discontinuities among the many. One you just pointed to, which is the failure to preserve online or e-materials that we might want. But there's also this other one that I think you may be pointing to, which is that producers, publishers may stop producing affordable books before the public, the readers, all have the electronic equipment that enables them to read?
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible. But as I said, I think a lot of people outside of publishing have this kind of linear idea that, certain kinds of works will always be produced. But they may be produced in a very niche-y way. The collapse of the traditional distribution system is leading to pretty significant differences in economics. For example, if you look at the way publishing used to work, you'd pay out in advance based on what you thought your advance in a different sense would be to the retail channel. So you'd go out there and you'd say, okay, we think we can sell this many to Barnes & Noble, this many to Borders, this many to the Independents, Ingram, Baker & Taylor will take these many. And that adds up to, and you, effectively the publisher was immediately, even, they weren't getting cash, but they were getting an accrual of, okay, I've sold in this many. So, there was sort of a predictability. Now, even if you might get a lot of returns later, you kind of had a working model. Now you go to sort of print on demand, you have some predictability of your manufacturing cost, albeit at a much higher level, but you don't actually get any subsidy from the channel because you're not pre-selling anything. You know, you can't afford to have inventory because no one is sharing the risk with you. To people outside the industry, they say, well, that all sounds like a good thing. You don't have any inventory risk, but you still have development risk. For a typical O'Reilly book, for example, the development cost is way greater than the manufacturing cost. You know, manufacturing cost is tiny for most books. You know, people don't realize it adds up if you print a lot of copies and a lot of thrown away. But for example, in our business, we were always pretty good at figuring out how many we thought we'd sell, and the volumes were sufficient to get us a reasonable manufacturing cost. Yeah, we're now pretty much all on demand using Ingram's Lightning Source. It's good because it does mean that we can you don't run into the fact that you have to take books out of print because there was not enough demand to get the volume for a reprint. It used to be, okay, you got to know that you can sell a couple of thousand to get the price reasonable. You know, because the prices are of the manufacturing costs really are hugely different for, say, 1 or 2,000 versus 10,000. And, when you go to print on demand, you get one predictable price, which is sort of, it's higher than your old, sort of 10,000 run cost, but a hell of a lot lower than your 1,000 run cost. And, it's generally better. And so, to a consumer, they say, oh, that sounds great. That's good for you. But it takes out of the equation the fact that there is still a development cost for the book.
Can you say a little bit more about the development cost and how much of that is borne by or potentially borne by the author and whether that's shifting?
Well, I think that's another whole, piece of the ecology. Authors have always been in the lottery business. Very few authors get paid what would really cost to produce that work. They're hoping to win the lottery. They're hoping that they will outperform. And again,
except
that's not
academic. Except academics. As soon as they get it published, they've won the lottery. So
right, exactly. Well, but I think that's part of it. So what do authors get out of publishing a book? They get increased status, which might allow them to do other things. For example, in our end of the publishing business, authors might get a better job. They might have consulting engagements. So the economic rewards are far from being limited to what they get in advance and royalties. There's still this sort of ecosystem effect. When we stop producing print books, you start asking, well, do you get the same reputation value that you used to get from a book? What's the difference between an ebook and a web page, for example? And you say, well, why would I go to all this trouble and overhead? And you have to ask yourself from a user point of view how much of a book was driven by the demands of the distribution system rather than really demands of the reader or the writer. Take the typical business book. I've had, I won't mention the name, but famous business book author. And I said, oh, I thought your original Harvard Business Review article was better. And he said, yeah, it pretty much had the whole thing in there. I had to pump a whole bunch of air into it to make the book.
That never happens.
Yeah. And why? Well, because, book has to be a certain length in order to appear on the shelves, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, there's sort of an irony to that because the users don't care about that. And we're starting to see that now in E, where people go, oh, yeah. A 50 page. That's all it takes is a 50-page, quote book. The irony for us, of course, is that's where we started at O'Reilly. We published what now would really be considered pamphlets. Our first books were 60, 70 pages. As we said, we were writing about individual Unix utilities and topics that everybody else said were too small for a book. But we didn't know any better because we were from outside publishing. And we said, hey, there's no documentation on SED. Let's write something. There's no documentation on UUCP. There's no documentation on VI. So they kind of grew up into books from being something else. And I think we're going to see that same evolution in ebooks. Right now we're
same evolution in that they will decompose into shorter books, or that
they'll decompose into different kinds of products.
You already do this. It's one of the many ways in which you've led the field here is you've
allowed access to chapters.
Yeah, although people don't really want that, to tell you the truth. Yeah, we've tried a whole lot of things. Say, okay, do people want to buy or download a chapter instead of the whole book? Do they want to, you know, even download pages? Yeah. And no, what it really is people want information that's crafted for the environment. You know, so they don't want to download a chapter of the book. They want, you know, a self-contained work that is the right length for their needs, and they no longer need the rest of it, you know, and I think that's one of the again, leaving, I'm not talking about fiction, which obviously is its own, you know, category, but I think you'll find that in a lot of cases, the book was a very, very inefficient way of giving people what they wanted. And, you know, so there are whole classes in you know, my business of computer book publishing where you go, oh, yeah, you know, some online documentation is way better because I only needed this little bit. You know, I can go to Stack Overflow and get the answer to my question. And so, for example, our publishing output has shifted hugely from reference-oriented books to tutorial, because tutorial, you still have that learning path. You've got to take, you know, if somebody says, I need the entire walkthrough to get me from nowhere to competence.
It has a type of narrative.
Yeah, has a kind of narrative to it that, you know, as opposed to, again, we always had sort of a narrative even in our more referency books, you know, the classic sort of tutorial slash reference, you know, book like Programming Perl, which is not exactly tutorial, but does have a progression and a narrative, but also is a comprehensive reference. But I think that the reference component, you know, certainly pure reference books are you know, pretty much dead on the web.
Because if you just want one answer, there are other places you can go to get it.
That's right, so, yeah.
Earlier on, you mentioned the real issue of trying to hold on to, preserve important items on the web that, you know, there's link rot. It goes away. You go back to something that's important historically from 1998 or whatever, and it's gone. Curation, preservation, these have been typically functions of librarians when it comes to books. Do you look to librarians also to help with that function for the broader range of web materials, or is this something that should be crowdsourced or a new institution?
I would guess that in some sense it will be new institutions. It'll be a new kind of librarian, in the same way that there's a new kind of publisher who has grown up on, you know, on the web or in app space or whatever, you know, people who figured out how to make use of the medium. But the job of the librarian, you know, I think is not singular. You know, there are a set of functions. You know, libraries certainly provide a function of free public access, but they do also provide this very, very important role of preservation. And I think it's a mistake for libraries to think about preserving only books. As we move towards an increased amount of publishing that's e-only, which I think is definitely in our future, whether or not books survive entirely, I think we may actually be within, you know, a decade of print books going away, going the way of the LP, i.e. they will still be produced, but only in certain specialty markets. The question of preservation then becomes one of digital preservation. And there are really two aspects to that. One is, oh my gosh, how fragile is the digital world? And, you know, should there be a function of libraries of figuring out how to make a real archival copy that might include print? You know, maybe the print on demand is one of the things that libraries do because they put it away somewhere to make sure that there's a copy. You know, any library that's sort of getting rid of its print collection and saying, oh, well, we're going digital, maybe going in the wrong direction in terms of that preservation role for libraries. But there's also this sort of digital curation. You know, what really matters? You know, I think right now of books that I've read recently, I've read a number of e-only books, you know, and will they be in libraries, you know, if they're Kindle only? But more importantly, when you think about the important source documents of this era, how many of them were in print? There are entire fields that did not grow up in print.
Do you have an example?
Well, let me give you just a very concrete example from my own career. I organized an event in April of 1998, which was originally called the Freeware Summit, later became known as the Open Source Summit because we got a group of free software leaders to agree to switch to this new term, open source software. And, I thought, oh, this is, historically significant. And so I kept links to a bunch of the articles about it. But, of course, I foolishly didn't actually make my own copies of those articles. And so if you go back and you look at my archive at tim.o'reilly.com and you go back and look at some of those original links, a bunch of them are 404. And I went, darn, okay, I need to actually make sure I preserve a copy. And you think how much of the early history of the web is gone, and nobody knew in 1992, 1993 that the web was going to become so important. Another great example, in 1993 when we introduced GNN, the Global Network Navigator, it was the first commercial website. And, we sat there and we're trying to remember, what did those first ads look like? And we couldn't remember. And we hadn't kept any copies. We eventually found an advertising brochure that we'd made that sort of showed what the first ads looked like. But we did the first ads on the World Wide Web, and they don't exist anymore. There's no digital copy of them. And maybe there is somewhere on a backup, at O'Reilly that some future, historian would find, assuming that they didn't get recycled, which they probably did. And there's very little there. The Internet Archive didn't start till some years later. And so most of the early history of the web is gone. And, of course, we saw the important economic impact of that with, for example, the Aeolus patent lawsuit against Microsoft. We actually had prior art on that, and we had actually shown it in public, but we had no records of that fact, and even though we testified in the the lawsuit, we just didn't have the records. And I think how often that is happening, the fields that are the world changing fields right now are often so much of what is going on is digital only. And if we don't preserve that, we're going to go back, just like now we say, gosh, we wish we had more of Sappho.
Paul Sappho.
No. With Sappho, the classical poet.
A
few fragments.
Okay. I thought we were still digital.
You think back in the classical world and the lost works, and the excitement if you we found this medieval manuscript and under the layer underneath is a poem of Archilochus, whatever. You go, holy crap, we just have this great find. We're going to be like that. We'll find some piece of digital, we'll recover some piece of digital history. But, in the same way that the books of classical antiquity, we have this spotty memory of, of the greatness of the past, and just what happened to be preserved defines our knowledge of that past. We will have in a similar way, we'll look back and we say, boy, we really wish we had, some of these early source documents of, that were really the shaping of our future.
But.
Yeah.
Since it is unknowable which documents are going to turn out to be source documents and which mm-hmm. are just going to be bad ideas, and we really want to, isn't this an argument for sort of pan-archivism as opposed to curation? So the Internet Archive approach, where you really want to get everything, even though that's an impossible problem, but as much as you can.
I think certainly... what Brewster is doing with the Internet Archive is probably and has been since the beginning the single most important thing happening in the library space in the Internet era. And I think people will look back on Brewster as an incredible visionary and a sort of a hero of digital preservation if they don't already.
He's also collecting specimen copies, as Kevin Kelly calls them, of paper books as well.
Absolutely. I think he really understands, the interesting crossover point that we're at. And it would be great if that effort were even more comprehensive. If if Brewster had the kind of funding that we have at the Library of Congress, for example, and say, okay, go to town. What else would you collect, Brewster? that would be a great investment. But I think there is also a role for curation by specialized communities. There is a role for people who care about something to think more carefully about digital preservation, for people who are in the library arena to actually build tools for digital preservation, so that the people who sort of care about the history of the things that they're doing are encouraged to follow certain kinds of best practices in preservation. It doesn't have to be, one great effort doing everything. I'm thinking, for example, of, the web itself. It's not like there's one big central web server. It'd be great, for example, just imagine if we had, every web server had GitHub-like functionality, the ability to sort of keep version control of everything that's been done in the past. And actually, take Wikipedia as an example that people outside software development would understand. There's revision history on Wikipedia, and you can go back and see all the history of every entry back to the beginning. So this, in some sense, digital preservation is built into Wikipedia, and digital preservation built into websites would be an awesome feature. And then the question also would be, when websites are going away, what responsibility do you have? Now, again, some people are going to care about that. Some people aren't. I think, what Google is doing with their data liberation front is really important, the right of people to take data out easily. But I don't think there's been enough attention paid to better tools for digital preservation and archiving by people who want to do it, who want to, have a library and advertise what's in that library. I was inspired to do, and I've done a relatively lousy job on it, my own personal archive at tim.o'reilly.com by what Carl Malamud has done on his sites. He has a site called, just a tab on his media.org site that's called Museum. And, it's his projects from the past. And he's done a pretty good job of archiving as he goes along. So, that, when you tell a story about how Carl Malamud put the SEC online in 1993, as compared to, say, what we did with GNN, he's got a pretty comprehensive archive, with images and, some of them, things like, here's the letter I received from, Representative Markey, here's the letter from the, SEC, he's done a great job of self-archiving and building his history. And I think more people ought to do that.
So part of the solution in viewing this as a distributed process where people, in addition to counting on the Internet Archive, but also making sure that your stuff is curated and preserved, is a best practice. And it's sort of like having an about page. Many sites have, it's a best practice now to have an about page for your site. The museum is like another really...
It's worthwhile. And again, I think, what's better, I mean, I love what Carl has done, but, if we had more sites with history built in, if version control were
a little standard markup, so
how
to navigate and find,
would be really, really good. And I think also a little more responsibility with, for example, redirects when people move things around or plan to take something offline. One of the things I find really, really irritating, for example, I look at old, where I kept old documents, and now the links point to some advertising page at the, we used to point to an article in a magazine, and they went, we don't really want to bother keeping that old article online. We'll point to our masthead, with where we can get some ad impressions. That's reprehensible. You've actually redirected it to, to give yourself value, but not provide the value that was originally there.
Not only did you break the chain of history, you've managed to...
Try to profit from it. Right. Yeah.
Tim, thank you so much.
Glad to talk to you.
Tim O'Reilly is the founder of O'Reilly Media, which has been in the publishing business since 1978. This podcast was brought to you by the Harvard Library Innovation Lab at Harvard Law School. We're interviewing a number of innovators, scholars, and publishers about the future of the written word. If you like this episode, why not follow along with us at librarylab.law.harvard.edu, where you can find out more about our work, including info on today's guest, join a discussion, and share this podcast with others. This show was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, and David Weinberger, with the support of the Harvard Law School.